What's up, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Our Lives in Medicine. This happens to be the last episode of Season 3, and I have some new things coming for Season 4, but in the meantime, I am super excited to introduce the one and only Siri. Siri is an emergency medicine physician, and she practices in NYC. By day, she saves lives in the emergency room. By night, she's a vigilante fighting crime. At least that's what she imagines as a huge superhero fan. Check out her journey to and through emergency medicine and listen to us as we nerd out about movies, superpowers, and Comic-Con. I hope you enjoy. And if you do, please share the episode with others. Also like us on Instagram at Our Lives in Medicine and comment on the things you enjoyed and the topics you'd like to hear in the future episodes. And as always, if you need some good beats to study or get some work done or just catch some good vibes, tune into the intro and outro and check the show notes for the artist shoutouts. I hope you enjoy and hope you have a great day. Sweet. So Siri, what's going on?
Living daily, doing good stuff and learning new things. What about you?
Pretty much the same. Not as cool as you though, obviously, living that EM life, but that's pretty awesome. And you said you didn't work today, right?
No, I didn't have work today. Today was one of my days off. So that's always nice.
Were you productive on the day off, or did you kind of just like Netflix and sweatpants all day?
Today I just recently, had a big move. So I just was kind of trying to organize some of my stuff into my new place.
When you move, how long does it typically take you to get like unpacked and everything?
I'm one of those people who I think doesn't pack very well. So unpacking takes even longer. So it's just as you need things, you kind of find them. That's more my style of moving. Although in retrospect, I think I wish I had been a little bit more organized. But I can find what I need. That's the important thing.
Yeah, that's all that matters. As long as you know where it is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. What about yourself?
I'm like a really organized packer, but like when I unpack, I just like, for example, I'd say I moved 6 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and I'd say that last week I finally finished unpacking everything, and it wasn't because I was already starting residency. I was here for 2 or 3 weeks before residency started, and I just like you said, I would just pick stuff up as I needed it and be like, oh, this will be fine. I'll leave it here for now. So
I find that those times where you feel like you need to be super productive, you will be. But until then, there's no need. And Netflix is waiting for you, or, you know, hanging out with your friends or whatever other task you have to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially when you live as an adult now, it's not like we're in high school anymore where like moms or dad's going to get mad if your stuff isn't unpacked. I can do whatever I want. Like, it's whatever. I'm in no rush at this point.
Exactly.
I got to get back used to living on my own. Cause like during quarantine, when I was in fourth year, I lived at home And I went from like living on my own for like 12 years to living with my mom for like, 4 months. And so that was
Oh,
a,
wow.
yeah, it was a very interesting condensed period of time living back home with mom. Like, and she wasn't like overbearing or anything. It was just more of, where are you going? What time are you coming back? Give me a call later, which is fine. It's just, I'm not used to it anymore, you know?
Oh my gosh, I can imagine. I had actually a pretty similar experience. So during the third and fourth year of medical school, we're allowed to do rotations either in our main campus hospital or we could do them at like a further site in like some of the more rural areas of Georgia. I went to school in Georgia. And basically, if we went to the more rural sites, they would give us housing. So you wouldn't have to pay for an apartment. So fourth year, I was like, I only need to take 7 or 8 electives, and I don't need to pay for an apartment for 5 months. I could just live with my parents. It was a strange time. I understand exactly what you mean. Like, they're not overbearing at this point, but it's more so just it's strange to after you leave home at a certain age and not being there like long term to come back and be like, oh yeah, wait, I like even if I come back at 2 and I'm like, at the hospital or something, that's like normal. But if I come back at 2 and I live at home, my parents would probably be like, where were you? Or why did your shift end so late? Or
Yeah, these
whatever.
questions I just don't have answers to. Like, or like, I never thought about the answer. It's like it just did. I don't know.
Is your mother in medicine?
She used to be an ICU nurse. She's just done like clinical nurse, like nursing research for the past like decade or so. So she hasn't been bedside in a hot minute, but she, when I was a kid, like when I was little, she was an ICU nurse.
Oh, okay. So she comes from like I think a place of understanding though of how kind of medicine is or works.
Yeah, she gets the late hours. The things that got her heated were like, for example, I take a shower, I throw my towel over the top of the shower curtain so they can like dry evenly. And she hated walking by the bathroom, which is like the open area bathroom, and seeing a towel draped over the shower curtain. So she'd always move it, and it would like get stinky in the middle because she'd fold it up and put it somewhere. I'm like, what are you doing? You're messing up my towel. And so just small stuff like that added up hugely over 4 months. But I loved living home with mom and seeing her every day, but that stuff like that just added up quick.
During the era of COVID, did you like decontaminate yourself like as you walked in the house, or how did that work?
Yeah, every time I came home, I hardly ever went out to the store or anything unless it was per my mom's request. And so I'd come home and decontaminate, kind of like you said, and throw the clothes right in the wash. But yeah, so plenty of towels folded over the shower curtain, that's for sure.
That's hilarious. Oh man, I think I'm fortunate and at the same time not fortunate. During most of COVID, I was living alone. So I was fortunate because whenever I did come home, even like trying to leave stuff at the door or whatever, like I wouldn't have to worry about exposing someone else necessarily. But at the same time, it was like I would watch these videos of people online who were like, I live with my entire family. I basically take off my clothes at the doorstep and that's it. Like they have to go straight to the shower. And it's very similar, but I felt like it was almost protective to live alone, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and you don't have to worry about it as much. Like you'd see those reports of like doctors coming home and sleeping in their garage so they didn't expose their family.
Yeah, that's and then now I think there's an entire shift. You're from the South, right? North Carolina, correct?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. So right now your cases are kind of on the rise. New York City got hit very early and we had no idea what was actually going on. And everyone in New York, I felt, more or less took this very seriously. Because at least they would know at least one or two people who got very ill for some reason, and they look at the news and they're like, oh wow, okay, so maybe it's this virus. So I think like everyone in New York caught on pretty quickly, and Cuomo made it really clear versus the rest of the United States, maybe because, you know, like in areas of North Carolina where there's farms or whatever, people already live like a mile apart. Mm-hmm. Like their socially distancing is like stay at home.
Just
like,
living,
don't go
yeah.
anywhere. Like it's very hard to see like the very like real effects of this virus when you're already like socially distanced. So it's fascinating to me to see like how hard it has been for some people who just kind of don't believe what's going on to make them believe.
I agree. Now, I will say with a disclaimer that true, the South numbers are rising, but I think that's kind of because of Florida specifically. Florida kind of went and did their own thing. They went rogue. And so now the South as a whole is getting a bad rep because like Florida's numbers are more than like everyone in the South combined, I think by far. So that's definitely kind of dragging us to the higher end, unfortunately. But when I was down in Florida for, you know, I went there for school and then I came home in February, and right after I came home, everything kind of shut down. I was like, man, I'm so glad I'm not down there anymore. Cause you know, the hot environment, which was shown pretty quickly to kind of perpetuate the virus. And then just kind of the culture of we're in Florida, we can do what we want, was not a good combo, but luckily plenty of people are getting it. Unfortunately, plenty of people are getting it, but luckily people are recovering well, and still the deaths are pretty low, but we'll see about the rebound effect. So hopefully we figure this out pretty soon.
Yeah. It's Florida. I'm watching the news very regularly because I don't live in Florida. And I think it's like crazy to me that they would allow these public spaces, which are really not very essential, to remain open in like a critical kind of national crisis. Just this week, Governor Cuomo added like 10 more states to our like quarantine list, and none of them make the news as much as Florida, like you said, or Georgia, where the governor has threatened to sue the mayor of Atlanta for mandating a mask like policy, which is fascinating to me as well. It's a very interesting time in history. And I think depending on what politicians and maybe what like public figures do or say is having a true impact on, I think even like the practice of medicine. People tend to practice medicine a little differently when there's more limited resources. There have been like, you know, several NEJM articles that have been published during this time on kind of resource management and ethical questions that may arise if, you know, ICUs are overwhelmed or whatnot. And in Florida, like specifically, recently there was some like numbers thrown out that, you know, the ICU numbers are very high at the moment. And as we have been learning, this virus has been affecting disproportionately the Black population and the Hispanic population, and especially down in like Miami-Dade and Broward County and all these like kind of more like Cuban rich counties, it might be affecting more that community than any other community. So I'm worried, and being from emergency medicine, this is also kind of a moment where you kind of are like, hey, we've been through this in New York City, learn from us, listen to us, just wear a mask and shut things that are not essential down. Like, nobody really needs a haircut necessarily. Like, everyone probably wants a haircut if it's very humid, but it's not really a need that drives, you know, life or death. So
I think that it's tough because certain people, especially with lower, you know, healthcare literacy, they just, it's not something they can see or it's not something palpable. So to them, it's like, oh, whatever, that's someone else's problem. I mean, I think if you were to say, exchange this virus for like decapitation, I think that would make it a lot more easy to distinguish what was necessary and what wasn't. Like, okay, if we go to this business, the risk of your head getting cut off versus, you know what I mean, versus catching a virus. It's like, and people, I think people would be a lot more willing to accept, like, yeah, maybe I don't need to go to the barbershop, you know, at the risk of decapitation. But at the risk of catching a virus, it's like, it's difficult for people, I think, to conceptualize what that means and not only understand that they catch it, they're totally fine. But they could infect others who might not be fine, and they'll end up on a respirator or end up, unfortunately, dead, you know? And that's the part that's hard to grasp. It's hard to look past the own consequence, your own results and consequences, and see what you can do to others.
So, so true. So, so true. I completely agree. I think people are very self-driven, and, you know, it's like, what's in it for me? Like, okay, so what if I'm an asymptomatic carrier? But, you know, also I saw this thing where it was like, well, if our grandparents knew that even if they were asymptomatic carriers and they can infect us, then you best believe that they would all be wearing masks. So is it just like being like, you know, younger, or is that just like our perspective, you know, or... is it like a cultural thing? Like, you know, if I'm surrounded by people who don't believe in masks, am I like more inclined not to wear masks? Is that like another thing, you know? It's kind of fascinating. And then there's still people who believe all this, this whole virus was like made up by people.
It's caused by 5G or whatever, yeah.
And I'm like, what do you think we're doing in hospitals if not caring for patients? Please, right. do enlighten me. I would love to know what you think.
Now, you were in the ER. You're in the ER when this started. What was kind of your experience when this kind of all went down?
So I was an EM resident, third year, when this started. So this virus, we kind of heard a little bit about it on the news, you know, from China. And I went to this huge conference, actually, in March, the beginning of March, where there was some sort of like competition. And initially, we had no idea how severe this virus was. And there were some schools already like banned from going to this conference because of what was perceived as the risk, and some programs that were banned from going to this competition. So at that time, we were just like, oh, they're not brave enough to come out here. And then about a week later, we find out that there were around 5 emergency physicians who tested positive for coronavirus, who attended this conference and probably propagated it to multiple people at the conference, because at time there was no concept of social distancing or wearing masks. The day after this like huge conference and competition, actually our hospital sent out an official email saying, hey, due to coronavirus, we're banning people from going to any conferences. They're not allowed to travel anywhere. I actually was supposed to do an international rotation in April, and I was actually supposed to get married in April too. And obviously none of that went down because of all of this, like the kind of buildup of everything that was going on. Our first coronavirus patient we saw at our hospital, it was an accidental finding.
Really?
Like on a CT of the abdomen, they were there for another reason. And we didn't even, you know, like it was some, I don't recall the exact case, but it was some case where it was an abdominal pain where we were concerned about some sort of surgical pathology. And in addition to having whatever surgical pathology they had, they got kind of like the bottom of the lungs. And it was like, hey, actually, the patient has ground glass opacities. This patient has coronavirus. And that was kind of our first patient, like kind of zero. And after that, it just, we started seeing more and more. And at one point in mid-April, kind of like beginning slash mid-April, all I was seeing was just coronavirus patients. And I was shocked because I was like, where did all the other pathologies go? What happened to strokes? What happened to heart attacks? Like every person we would see would either be like fever and cough and they would be well enough or have like have minimal oxygen requirements where they wouldn't really require anything to stay in a good saturation. So we would either be like, hey, our hospital's a little overwhelmed right now. You don't really need to stay at the hospital, so we're sending you home. Or they would be like, you know, requiring a lot of oxygen to kind of maintain their saturations. And a general rule of emergency medicine is you don't send anyone who you believe is going to crash home. So a lot of these patients ended up, you know, ended up requiring alternate methods of ventilation, such as high flow or even, you know, intubation. Ultimately, we had a lot of young patients, and one patient in particular kind of made the news. It was a young guy who was 30 years old, initially came in requiring like nasal cannula, so you can't really go home on a nasal cannula, was admitted to the hospital, but in the ED kind of decompensated, required high flow. And at that time, our hospital had created a whole bunch of new ICU beds and two new ICUs. And it was staffed by emergency medicine and anesthesia and internal medicine and a bunch of other specialties, basically, that all came together and were like, hey, we're ready to take care of sick patients. And we also had a emergency ICU downstairs that would take care of kind of like the high flow patients to keep an eye on them, because we're, you know, one of the few specialties that are truly trained in kind of the crashing patient and making sure that they can get intubated ASAP if they need it. So yeah. This patient, the 30-year-old, actually made the news. He was in the hospital for 70 days, and after requiring so much oxygen, ultimately required something called ECMO to keep him alive for a long period of time. So I think he was on ECMO for 30 days as well. So
woof.
It was 70 days in the hospital, 30 days on ECMO, and he was only 30 years old with no other medical problems.
Wow.
So that's one of the, I think one of the things that I've learned is we don't truly know what happened to a lot of these patients, but some of them were so young and so healthy and became so frail.
Now, sorry, your experience. What was your question? No, yeah. And I mean, obviously, I'd love to hear what you're saying. So I was just going to kind of follow up with that. Him being 30 years old and just kind of decompensating that bad, is that typical in your experience, or is that kind of atypical for that age? Would most of the people that age kind of just maybe come down a little bit, be in the hospital for a few days, or did most of them kind of require an extensive workup and treatment plan?
Being 30 years old, is that normal? So basically, 30 years old is young, obviously. We don't usually expect young patients to get sick. A lot of our demographics that we were seeing was kind of all over the place. Generally, for our pediatric population, we did see multi-system inflammatory kind of reaction that was later published as being like a thing. We saw a few cases of those, but generally speaking, patients who were 18 to 40, when they got sick, they got really, really sick. Like, especially if they came to our hospital, we were seeing like, you know, 30 and 40 year olds, some of them who did not make it, and they were very sick. If they were kind of like most, I think most 30-year-olds or most 40-year-olds, if they were just feeling kind of minimally ill, they never came to our hospital, or at the time, New York City didn't have enough testing capabilities to really like address their needs, I guess. So they just kind of self-quarantined and either got better or got so bad that they did come. What was the second part of your question?
I think that was pretty much it. That was definitely it. Just kind of, is that bad of a decompensation in that age typical? And it sounds like if they came in, it was because they were sick already, like pretty struggling already. So maybe it was, but maybe not everyone who contracted it probably didn't go that bad. But still, I mean, 70 days in the hospital, 30 days on ECMO. I mean, that's no joke. That's a terrifying experience. And also, that's going to be a terrifying bill when he does recover. So
I don't even want to think about the bill. I think that just like thinking about it, a lot of the healthcare costs during this pandemic are going to be from the COVID patients, because a lot of the hospitals have shut down outpatient services, rightfully so. Like no one needs to get an elective surgery when there's a pandemic. But hospitals are losing a lot of revenue because of this. And there's also been, I think, like in terms of the way doctors operate, there's been a huge change. A lot of people have tried to switch over to telemedicine capabilities and do more like telehealth visits so that they can continue to kind of at least get some income. I think that also that's going to change how people have been billed. Like, are they going to charge someone or how much is like Medicare and Medicaid going to cover for, you know, a pandemic patient? Like, is it gonna, like, you know, this, the hospital that I worked at, it actually was in a pretty underserved area, I would say. A lot of diversity in Brooklyn, and a lot of people who I would say were on Medicare or Medicaid, and what they sometimes would say to me is, hey doc, I don't have insurance. Like, this was even before the pandemic. Like, I don't have insurance. What can I actually afford? If I was sending them home, like, you know, that's something to consider. Like, oh, will my patient actually be able to take the medication I'm giving them, because can they afford it? Or will my patient even stay in the hospital and get a procedure done? Because if they can't afford it, then they might be like, hey, I can't afford it. And yeah, it's an interesting issue that you bring up with like the healthcare cost and the cost for the patient. And I think that during this election, that's something that people are definitely going to need to consider voting on. It's also, you know, what do they want the future of healthcare in America to look like?
I think healthcare is going to be a huge running point for a lot of people. Maybe not Kanye, but in general.
He dropped out.
Oh, already? That sucks. I was kind of looking forward to the entertainment. I mean, can you imagine Kanye versus Trump in like a presidential debate?
Oh my gosh. That would be, he would probably like wrap it away and be like, nah.
Yeah. You know? You talk about making history. That would be a historical event right there. But no, in all seriousness, though, I think that will be a really important running point. I mean, what's been a bigger topic in 2020? I mean, I know we had World War III, kind of. I know we had Australia burning. I know we had, like, some important deaths and things like that. But, like, what's been a bigger topic in 2020 than coronavirus and healthcare in general? So, and research, too, you know, just kind of clinical research and how important that has been. I think those will be really big running points.
Exactly. I think that if there is a change in our government, definitely there might be more allocation of money to important research that's going on right now, even regarding the development of vaccine or, you know, basic science research, so that our country can continue to move forward. So
I think one possible issue, though, is maybe too much attention will get drawn to corona, and then other things will become, you know, quote unquote, less sexy to research. So, you know, ALS or, you know, nutrition deficiency, metabolic disorder, things like that, those will get put on the way back burner. They're already kind of on the back burner. So they'll lose even more tread. And that's kind of an unfortunate, especially for a virus that is so undetermined. I guess we need research to determine what exactly we're up against. But to an extent, I mean, it does have a high recovery rate compared to like these other metabolic disorders. It's just more people are affected by this high recovery rate virus than they are by this crippling metabolic disorder or something, you know? So it's kind of hard to say, which way do we focus money and which way do we focus time? I think that parents of kids suffering from these diseases will be kind of the ones who miss out on opportunities in the future, unfortunately. But it's one thing at a time. That's all, I guess. I don't know the answers, unfortunately. That's it. That's all we can say is kind of just discuss it. But
You bring up some really good points, actually. It's unfortunate, but I think those long-term like diseases, those chronic illnesses are definitely getting less attention and less funding, given that a lot of our current funding is going towards the pandemic and COVID-19. It is going to be, I think it's going to be imperative that we find a vaccine, because this entire virus has changed our lives and the way we live. So albeit it does have, you know, a high recovery rate for people who can recover from it, it's still been the talk of the town, as you said.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So it's going to be interesting to see kind of the presidential the political discussions and the journal articles that keep coming out. I think, unfortunately, too, it's going to get boring scientifically pretty soon, because, you know, every journal article for the next probably 12 to 18 months is going to be, not every obviously, but a lot of journal articles are going to be just some kind of tiny little nitpicky area of research on COVID, and it's going to get saturated, I think, pretty quickly, because it's, why wouldn't you jump in on that bandwagon and get your name out there, get funding, get money in your lab and everything, and just kind of focus on one little minute detail that may not necessarily lead to any improvement in the current situation, but it'll just kind of get your name notoriety. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that in the future. Hopefully it stays interesting and doesn't just get boring and saturated.
I can tell you with my experience, as an emergency physician, we went into this for kind of the variety of patient complaints that we see, the stories in the ED. It was a lot of, it was very emotionally draining, because a lot of people who maybe wouldn't have gotten sick from other things got very sick from COVID and ultimately didn't have a good outcome. But it was also kind of in our emergency department, when we talked to like each other, the staff, it was like another respiratory distress. Like, who doesn't have respiratory distress? Like, is this the only complaint that we're seeing? Why does everyone have the same story? Like, it's just like you said, it could get boring in terms of research, but it could also get taxing to continually just do the same thing in and out if there's, you know, there's no variety, or the reasons that you are doing something kind of start to fade, I guess. That's something that drew most EM docs to the field, and having just COVID all the time would get very draining. True. Just because it would all be just respiratory distress. I mean, while we're very good at dealing with respiratory distress and we're very well trained to be able to intubate someone and place them on a ventilator, I don't think that's the only thing that, you know, most EM docs want to do for the rest of their lives. I think right. They enjoy sometimes the stories of people tripping and falling in the bathroom and ending up somehow with a foreign body somewhere. Like, yeah. You know, I enjoy that.
Right. Yeah. You can't just do respiratory distress. You got to have the MVAs, the, you know, the meth and amphetamine overdose, you know, coming in acutely agitated, the diabetic foot wounds, all that stuff is important too.
Oh, I love those. I love those complaints right there. I'm actually happy. So I think kind of near the end of, you know, our first true wave, I would say, in New York City, we started getting like the regular complaints of people like back, the people who were too afraid to come in, or those who would come in and you were like, why are you like actually here? And it just made me really happy one day. It was just like a few young kids who decided to show up to the emergency department at 3 a.m. to get tested for HIV. And I was like, this is when you know that the first wave of coronavirus is truly going down.
The fear is dying.
They're not afraid to be here. They're not afraid to be here. And all they want is just testing. And I was like, you know, you're not even going to get the result today. Like, it's 3 a.m. in the morning. Like,
what were you doing before that you couldn't come earlier? Like, why?
maybe, you know, I do think that every patient has a story, and that's my favorite part about medicine, is to listen to people's stories, or like, you know, listen to their complaints and feel their pain and help them through the process. And the kind of silly things that you wonder, you know, working on a night shift, you know, regularly people don't spend Saturday night in the hospital. That's not something that I don't think a regular person wants, you know? Mm-hmm. And whenever, you know, they come in for a complaint at an odd time, I always like to ask, why now? Mm-hmm. What happened specifically at 2:30 in the morning that motivated you to come here for this? I want to know, because I want to be able to best address that need, you know? Because nothing is open or like overnight. None of the consultants are really very available. And what we mainly do overnight is stabilization. And if the patient is stable, we hold them till the morning for a consultant if it's, you know, more or less emergent. And if it's not emergent, then we discharge them with outpatient follow-up. So it's fascinating to me. And then there's some patients who come into the hospital and they're like, I need my discharge paperwork now. And I'm like, I just drew your blood 2 seconds ago. I'm confused. Like, did you come into the emergency department because you wanted help, or what can I do for you? I think that's an important question to ask.
Oh, definitely.
Even in the outpatient setting.
Yeah, just what can I do for you, though? So obviously you're the expert, being the emergency medicine physician and resident, but my 1 month during fourth year, I had one patient come in. I worked 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift, and it was like 3 in the morning, kind of like we were talking about, and this guy said he's having chest pain. So they obviously got him back there pretty quick, and I'm like, well, when did your chest pain start? And he said, it all started 8 years ago when he told me, that man proceeded to tell me his life story from 8 years ago. And I just sat there listening. I was in shock at how long that person talked without taking a single stop, like a single break for me to interject at all. And it was, but it's again, it's just like the patient wanted to be heard, and I gave him his time. And finally, I was like, all right, well, I didn't ask any other questions after he told me that story. I just said, all right, well, we're going to get an EKG, and we're going to do some workup, and we'll get you figured out. But that was a tough one. And then I had another guy come in who had a fire truck, like a little model fire truck in his rectum. And I asked... In his rectum. And I asked, you know, why, what happened? You know, what happened to you? Expecting to hear, oh, I fell. And he was like, well, honestly, I just wanted to see if it would fit. So I was like, it's fit. And it got lodged up there, man. It tightened up and it's not coming out. He had to get surgery, actually, because it went way up. I mean, it was like in the sigmoid almost. I mean, it was up there. Like, when we got the x-ray, it was up there. He had to get surgery to get it out.
Are you serious? Oh, yeah. My gosh. That's like, oh, wow. So actually, I think of the complaints that I enjoy the most, I really love foreign bodies. Some of them are scary, but I really enjoy Pete's foreign bodies. They're fascinating. I had a patient once swallow it was like a three-year-old who was playing around with six magnets that would stick to each other. And the dad was like, he swallowed two magnets. And I'm like, what? Like, what was he doing? And he's like, oh, he was just, you know, trying to test if, you know, they were actually metal or not. And then he accidentally swallowed them. And I was like, what kind of parents lets a kid just do this? So not only did he swallow these magnets, the patient was from lived in Brooklyn, but was upstate. So it was around 4 hours away. So the first thing the dad thought of was to put the patient in the vehicle and drive 4 hours to get checked out at our hospital. At which point it was already like 1 a.m. And I was like, oh my gosh, like you couldn't have just gone to a hospital, you know, closer to where
along
this
the way
happened.
Yeah. Wow.
It's fine. Obviously, we're open to, you know, all the patients. We want to treat everyone. But at that point, the magnets had progressed so far that, you know, they would require kind of either endoscopic retrieval or surgery. So the issue with magnets is that they stick to each other and they can actually, if there's tissue in between, it could cause tissue necrosis. So it's one of those objects that must be retrieved if swallowed. If you swallow two, if you just swallow one, then it's fine. You just eventually it just goes down. But he swallowed two, and I was like, "Are you serious? You couldn't just swallow one."
I know, right? Give him one at a time. That's freaking magnets, man. That's hilarious.
That's a good case.
That is pretty cool.
People are always afraid. So emergency medicine doctors, we do a lot of rectal exams, a lot. Because all the GI bleeds, all anemias. One time my friend, someone came in with rectal pain and he did a rectal exam, one of my co-residents, and felt a chicken bone in the rectum.
What?
Yeah, our patient population, they seem to always swallow chicken bones. And if it isn't like an upper, like GI foreign body where, you know, we go in and we just kind of retrieve it from the back of their throat with like a laryngoscope, it becomes a lower GI body. So he used an anoscope to retrieve it, and it was just something that you couldn't even see. It was so small you couldn't even see it on the x-ray, or like he got a CT scan, but it was so small that it was like hard to tell, and it was between some mucosa, and you had to do like a 3D reconstruction of the CT scan to really tell it was there, but it was all on exam.
So he felt it.
Satisfying. Yeah, he felt, so he came in, the patient came in for rectal pain. He did a bedside digital rectal exam and was like, I think I feel a bone, and retrieved it. It was a great case. It was like, those are the kinds of things that I feel like you truly can help people with.
Yeah.
You know, they just feel great after and they go home leaving so much more satisfied. And then there's things that you really can't, you know, help too many people out in the emergency department, because if you come in with DKA and you're not taking your diabetes medication, that's going to require a lot more than me or the ICU doctor. That's going to require like long-term changes. But some of this more like basic, like stabilization and kind of like fun complaints, as I call them, are something that I do enjoy. And I did miss a lot during this time.
I bet, yeah. I just wanted to, I think you like, you might like this one too. I'm on peds right now, inpatient. And we had this girl, she was like, she was young, and I can't remember how old, but she was young, and she kind of just had these like indescript kind of just like chest pains and cough and things like that. And we're thinking, oh, it's probably COVID or it's flu or something. So we get a chest x-ray and there's like some weird opacity, and they couldn't figure it out on CT. So they ended up just bronching her, right? Like going down in her lungs. And she had aspirated like a huge chunk of chicken, like she was eating like a week ago.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And her mom's like, you didn't remember choking on chicken? Like, what is wrong with you? And the daughter's like, I don't know. I don't remember. Like, you don't remember choking on chicken? What's wrong with you? And it was like all gross and like dead and rotting. It was like a week old piece of chicken.
Oh my
God. Oh. It was very disgusting. It was like a good probably like, you know, bite of chicken that this little girl just aspirated and went right into her lung. It was so gross.
Did she have pneumonia or anything?
Luckily, no. She didn't get any pneumonia, at least not acutely. She might have come back or something and been treated outpatient or something. But when we were in there, there was just kind of like a bunch of mucus around it. But when they took it out, the mucus kind of floated out with it. So that was good.
That's actually like a really good case. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was fun. And luckily I didn't have to do the bronch and like actually smell the piece of meat, because the surgeon said it was pretty gross in the OR. It smelled pretty bad.
Oh man. That's a good case. The kids swallow everything. They also put everything in every orifice though. You'll find like cockroaches in their ears, or, you know, like beads in their beads in the nares is like such a common complaint that I see all the time. And it's so satisfying because the mom will be like, I swear there's a bead in the nares, and you'll swath a kid that's like, you know, 2 or 3 years old, and you're putting a Foley into like their nostril, and like you pull on it, and all of a sudden like a, you know, bead just like flies out, and the kid feels so much better. And then the mom is like, you're God. And you're like, I'm just a regular human being that some, some capabilities.
Like, I'm awesome. I don't know about God, but I am pretty sweet, though. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, my superpower.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Why I work here.
when I was a little kid, I put a, like, my mom was making, like, beans. She was just, you know, soaking the beans, and she was going to cook them. And I took one and just shoved it up my nose for some stupid reason as a kid. And I thought I was going to just shoot it out. I was like, Mom, watch this. And I like, it got stuck and I couldn't shoot it out. And I started like kind of panicking.
No.
And she just grabbed me, you know, ICU nurse. She just grabbed me. She had long nails and she just stuck her nail right past it and flicked, like popped it out. I mean, it was deep in there because I shoved it like long ways up my nose. And she just like dug in there and popped it out. And then she grabbed me. She's like, what is wrong with you? Why would you do that? So she saved me first, and then she made sure I didn't do it again. So,
oh my gosh, I can imagine. That's like, damn, that's like really cool that your mom can do that.
Yeah, she didn't even freak out or anything.
Hey, advantage of having a mom with long nails and the ability to know what to do, I guess.
Yep. Nerves of steel, that's for sure.
Yeah, did your mom inspire you to try to pursue the medical field?
She did in a way. So she was more of this. I kind of wanted to do healthcare all along, except for one little tiny stint in college. I actually switched up and was doing engineering for a bit. But she kind of encouraged me to at least shadow in high school. And she set me up with a couple different specialists and just to shadow. And that was really fun. I loved it. And luckily, I had good experiences where they were nice, most of them. I did have this one, I tell this story to my friends, I had this interventional radiologist who I shadowed for a whole summer. And I asked him one day, I was like, so do you like interventional radiology? And he goes, well, Everett, you know, I have a really nice car. I drive it to work and I drive it home. That's it. He said, my kids don't know me and they can't stand when I'm around. He said, I know my wife is cheating on me, but I don't have time to deal with it. I come to work and I'm underappreciated by my coworkers. And yeah, my life is kind of just a joke at this point. He goes, so do I like IR? I don't know. let's go see some patients. He's just, I was like 16 at the time. He just like, I don't know. Anyway, let's go see some patients. And that was it. He just kind of just said all that to me and kept walking on with his day. And I was standing there with my jaw dropped. Like, what did I just hear from this adult human being?
Oh my gosh. It sounds like he did not find a lot of things in his life very fulfilling.
Yeah.
And so I think that maybe dissuaded you from pursuing an interventional radiology, if I was everything.
Yeah, I was sold correctly. Not to do IR for sure. IR was not on my list of possible things to do.
It's a long ways to become a IR physician.
It's like 7 years, right?
Yeah, I think they have combined IR programs now. But back when I applied, that was a relatively new thing. I didn't apply to IR, but like to residency, they had those 4-year radiology residencies, and then you would do an additional 1 or 2 years. So that's still 6 years. But I think if you straight up just did IR, it's like integrated or interventional, like that where you would just do everything at once, it was even longer. Mm. But it's a very desired field. You're basically, in my light, you're like a proceduralist. You are pretty much a surgeon. You do a lot of things that, you know, most surgeons would do, but very different training process. So, I don't know.
Let me ask you this. You obviously, when it came time to apply, do ERAS, you were like, all right, EM is my number one. This is what I'm going to do. What were your, like, 2 and 3 or 4 things? Like, if you were like, all right, EM, I changed my mind, I'm going to go to the next step, like the next specialty, what would kind of been like your second or third and fourth choice?
Ah, interesting question. So if I had to kind of figure out like what I wanted to do again, I didn't have a whole lot of exposure to field of anesthesia, but it's something that I was definitely, and still, like, I enjoy most of, like, pharmacology, intubations, all that. I like anesthesia. And then I am, but I hate rounding. So probably not.
But yeah, rounding is the worst, honestly.
Yeah, if it wasn't for rounding, like, I would consider doing, like, a, you know, like a subspecialty, like, you know, rheumatology, like something procedurally based. And I also, while I liked actually doing surgery, I also did not enjoy like the hours or, you know, anything like that. So I don't know, those would kind of be my differentials, I guess, for what I would do if I had to go back. I enjoyed family medicine as well. It's just a lot of outpatient, but something that I was really thinking about is, if there were a zombie apocalypse, what would give me the most practical skills to survive? And ER, like, hands down. We have all sorts of subspecialties, and we treat people from birth to death, which is something I think we share with family medicine. And we really treat people when they're kind of the most vulnerable. And I'm also like the first doctor to see a patient usually, like not in the outpatient setting, but when they come to a hospital for a particular complaint, I am the first person to see them for that complaint usually. And to me, that's, I'm the detective. Like, hey, like what are my, then I have to formulate kind of theories of what I think is going on. Or maybe I'll even figure out what's going on, you know? And then I pass the ball on to someone inpatient. But for me, that's something that I've always wanted to do my entire life, is play the detective game, kind of like continually being challenged and trying to figure out, you know, what is truly causing someone to feel pain and suffering, and try to figure out how I can best help them, in kind of the initial, in their initial path to recovery. So,
yeah,
I think that's why emergency medicine for me was like a hands down, this is my first choice. But a lot of the other fields I've listed, if you notice, they also kind of have a broad scope of practice, and they treat people from birth to death, pretty much.
That's true. That's cool. I'm glad you found your niche, though, within that, but that's still cool to think, you know, you doing gas or you doing, like, you know, even family, that'd be so different, kind of. Even this interview, I feel like, would be very different, but that's cool that you, you know, landed in the right place, it sounds like.
I actually got very lucky, I think, because I think I found the specialty that I like, but I also found kind of the practice that I wanted to train in. And in New York City, I would say, like, hospitals are kind of like ruthless places. Like, they are more like a third world country than like a fancy hotel. The patients that come to our hospital, even pre-COVID, whatever, they never truly had rooms. It would just be beds and stretchers kind of next to each other. And sure, we have like a couple of isolation rooms per se, but it's like, you know, there's such a limited amount of resources, and it kind of shapes how you practice medicine. And we do an away rotation at the University of Maryland, actually, at Shock Trauma Medical Center. And there, everyone has their own, like, room, their own, like, TV. Like, it's kind of like a hotel. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating to me because I was like, the floors are so clean. I feel like walking on these floors, I'm dirtying them with my dance goes. It's like very different. So I've learned a lot of things, like with also like nursing or having a high patient volume, all these other things. Like, you know, sometimes I would just start IV fluids on my patient if they needed them. And I don't think that's kind of how other people, like even EM residents across the nation, if you have enough nursing staff and you have enough kind of ancillary staff, you just kind of don't do those things. So this interview would be very different if I was a family physician. I can tell you that. I'd be like, preventative care.
Yeah, exactly. Lifestyle medicine, yeah.
You know, actually, there are some EM doctors who practice lifestyle medicine. Did you know this?
That doesn't surprise me, because that's such a cool future kind of in medicine right there. So I feel like anyone who'd want to get involved would be smart to do so.
I think so as well. That's definitely true. What about you? If you didn't do family, what would you do?
So my top three were, like, so I'm doing family, and then I'm going to do a sports med fellowship. That's my number one by far. My number two was actually medical examiner. I loved it. I loved my time with the ME. It was like cool lifestyle, cool job, really good pay, and just like don't have to deal with a lot of other stuff. And when I told people, I was like, oh, I'm actually considering medical examiner, they're like, oh, but you're so social and you're so personable. And I'm like, yeah, that's true. But as an ME, I can save my social, you know, my social skills for after work. I don't have to be on all the time. You know, that's kind of one of the pluses. That's a wild specialty. The thing that kind of turned me away from it, though, is it takes a little bit longer, and I'm already 30. So I didn't want to do like 5 or 6 years if I didn't have to. But it was medical examiner was pretty cool. And then my third was psychiatry. I actually really liked psych a lot.
Okay. So medical examiner and then psychiatry.
Yeah. If I hadn't done sports, I would have done either ME or psych, most likely. And then PM&R probably number four.
What path would ME be through?
You do pathology, and then you do like general path, and then you do medical examiner fellowship. I think the ME fellowship is 2 years, I believe.
Okay. Cool. Very, very interesting. Whenever I think medical examiner, do you know this like show on TV The one just becologist becomes a zombie.
No, what is that one called?
Oh man, it's hold on, I'm gonna tell you. It's I don't recall, but it's like a pathologist who becomes a zombie, and it was relatively recent. iZombie. That's what it was called.
I've not heard of that. Actually, that sounds awesome.
So, I mean, the show itself is about how she somehow, through some path that gets unraveled throughout the show, becomes a zombie. And in order to survive as a zombie, she needs to eat brains. And luckily, because she's a pathologist and is also a medical examiner, she eats the brains of the victims that she gets sent after she does their pathology. Wow. And then she starts to figure out like how they died and stuff based on eating their brains or something like that. It's kind of like it's more it's not really medical at that point, you know. it's more of like oh, this is kind of like interesting. It's an interesting show.
She's like, this tastes like a hypertensive crisis, or this tastes like cholesterol excess.
Exactly.
That's kind of funny though.
That's one of the shows that I think of. And then the last choice you said was
psych, and then maybe PM&R.
Psychiatry. That's a good field. It's actually, there is a growing need. I was going to say there's a growing need for psychiatrists, especially with everything that's going on right now. And with COVID, there's a lot of kind of trauma that people are suffering emotionally, and there's a lot of collective trauma as well for healthcare professionals. And I think everyone is about to get a therapist to kind of go through, you know, everything that's going on. And I encourage that. Mental health in America is booming as a field.
Yeah, you're right. And as well, I mean, it's been referred to kind of as the new derm in a sense, because depending on where you're practicing and what setting, you can have a really chill lifestyle. I mean, you can work 3 or 4 days a week, make, you know, 300 plus K, and kind of still see like an acute or long-term difference in your patients, or both even. And so it's pretty interesting. It's an interesting field. I liked it a lot. I liked inpatient. I liked outpatient. I would even consider doing like addiction med fellowship off of it. I mean, I really liked, there's a lot to offer from psychiatry.
Something that you can consider still in family medicine is there is a psychiatry kind of offshoot of, it's like a combined program usually, but I think you can still do like some sort of subspecialty. But sports medicine's really cool. So, I mean, you could do both. You could do like your own thing. That's like the cool thing about medicine is you can formulate your own niche.
Yeah, that's true. I think, unfortunately, though, like I said, I'm 30 now. Once I get done with that fellowship, I'm done. I'm not doing any more training. I'm not doing any more school. I've been in school my whole life. I think I'm ready to actually work now. I worked for a few years before med school, but other than that, I'm ready to finally get a real person job and be a big adult finally.
It makes sense. The medical journey itself is many, many years. And I congratulate you on starting a residency. It's an exciting time, but training itself is draining. And I totally understand where you're coming from.
Also, well, I appreciate that.
Then you get to do what you want to for the rest of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, obviously, congrats to you, too. You just finished residency and you're in your fellowship now. So congrats to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I'm very excited for a lot of the projects and stuff that I'm working on. And I'm very excited for, I guess, kind of, you know, because of COVID, emergency medicine has actually been getting more recognition as a specialty. We're not just your triage doctors, you know? So it's kind of, it's a really exciting time to be in medicine. And as dangerous as it is, like after we get through this, like I feel like there's going to be more changes for the better. and the things that deserve attention or might get more attention.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a completely different question now. So let's say we go back, you're 18 years old, you're about to start college, and you know, you have your whole life ahead of you. What would, if you weren't in medicine and you weren't in healthcare, what do you think you'd be doing instead?
This is a really good question. I like this question. 18 years old, I just started college. So in college, I came in with a few credits already. And I thought I wanted to do pre-med, but I also thought I wanted to do a lot of other things. So I took all these like really, I would say non-traditional classes for pre-med. I took a class about how in Scandinavian literature, where basically we watched horror movies all day and talked about them. I took like a class on documentary filmmaking because I thought I had a future in filmmaking. I can assure you that I'm not an editor, a film editor by any means. I did enjoy it. It's something that I think that if I had more time, maybe I would pursue. I thought I wanted to do journalism, so I kind of got into a little bit of that. I think I was so lucky because I got to take a lot of classes that a lot of pre-meds did not take. And it has really shaped, I think, my decision to actually pursue medicine. So straight up, if, you know, if I can go back, like something that I would find myself really happy doing, and I told a friend this recently, is I would do personal training. I love it. Mm. Like, I think that leading a healthy lifestyle is so important, and I just love seeing people grow and develop. And I feel like personal training is almost a form of like mentorship, where you can like really make a difference in people's lives and change their lives, you know. So that's like, I think that's one of the careers I would do. And if I was better at it, maybe even like filmmaking, like documentary filmmaking. I'm very interested in like real social issues, and especially as they relate to medicine. But you know, in general, like I wanted to learn more about the world and how that kind of, you know, shapes our lives, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know if that's like the answer that you would have expected,
that,
but
definitely is a sweet answer, I think. And I wanted to ask a follow-up because you said you kind of watched a lot of horror movies in that one class, you said?
Yeah, I did.
I love horror movies. That's like my jam. Like scary movies, horror, like gore, whatever. I love them all. So do you still kind of watch those, or is that kind of a thing of the past?
Oh, and I love kind of that genre. But I'm interested in like kind of the mystery horror kind of mix. I've watched all three seasons of Stranger Things.
Oh, yeah.
And also, actually, I personally loved the Purge series. Like, that's like the kind of horror that I enjoy because it's also like human psychology. And, you know, there's like, no one can deny that human psychology is fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
So, like there was actually the Purge TV show, which I've watched both seasons.
Was that good? Because I have that queued up to maybe, I've seen the movies, but that show looks pretty sweet, actually.
It's actually pretty good. I mean, especially if you like the show and the idea of kind of, you know, like what would happen in one night and why are people doing the things that they do. In addition to kind of like that suspense, like, oh snaps, like this person is being chased down the street. Are they going to die? Are they going to be shot? What are they going to run? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I did like the show. I would say the first season is better than the second season, but I did enjoy the show. I watch, like, I mean, a lot of the horror movies that I used to watch were in Japanese. Like the original Japanese, like Purge or like other, you know, movies from the original thing.
Back that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I think I can definitely provide you with a list.
Oh, please. That would be amazing. I would love that. And, you know, just as an aside, the guys who wrote the Stranger Things, they're actually from my hometown. They grew up, they went to high school down the street from where I went. And I used to play their high school in lacrosse and soccer, actually.
No way.
Yeah, the Duffer Brothers.
And this was where?
Durham, North Carolina.
Oh, okay. So... Interesting.
So a lot of the places a lot of the roads that they shout out in that show are roads that I used to drive on every day in high school and like middle school and stuff.
Very, very cool. That's a fun fact that you shouldn't keep to yourself.
Yeah. Well, another fun fact, these two kids who went to my high school as their senior project started a company that became Eurosport, which is the biggest distributor for soccer equipment and gear and like fan paraphernalia and everything in the world. It's the biggest like soccer company, like distribution company in the world. And they went to my high school and I unfortunately did not drink the same water they did. So,
well, that is also, wow. It seems like a lot of successful people. Look at that. You went to high school in Durham, North Carolina, and there's all this big buzz that you wouldn't know that would come about.
But now it's here. Durham is an interesting place because on the flip side, I don't know if you saw the documentary The Staircase on Netflix, but
no, I didn't.
Well, it's about Michael Peterson, and he lived down the street from where I grew up as well. And actually, you know, my girlfriend texted me like last year during Christmas and was like, oh my God, I just saw Michael Peterson at Home Depot buying a Christmas wreath. And so, yeah, that was interesting. It's an interesting place, Durham.
Huh. I will have to look up what The Staircase is about. Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, that happened right down the street from me.
Oh, that's kind of scary. That kind of stuff puts you on edge. Like,
Well, I got another story for you from my high school then, that one puts you on edge. There's a kid, I don't know. I feel like I should be okay to say the name. It's a public record. It's on the news. So the name is Adam Sapakowski. And he was a year above me. And basically, he had decently strict parents. They were nice people, but they were strict and would not let him throw a prom party. And so he wanted that party really bad and ended up murdering them and having the party with them dead upstairs. And then the smell got so bad that he kind of checked himself into a hotel and didn't go back to the house. And finally, after like 2 weeks of them missing, you know, family friends called the police and had them check up on them, and they found the bodies. And so that kid, I don't remember if he finally maybe got caught right after graduation or it was before graduation. I can't remember. That was like, it's a long time ago, but it was like 12, 13 years ago. But yeah, that happened in my high school as well. So that's a weird place. Wow. Durham is an interesting place. So in my high school, it was very interesting as well.
That's a crazy high school. I wonder if they list these people as like kind of like famous alumni, you know, on your high school website.
I know, right? I know, like, they list the Eurosport guys.
Do they want to acknowledge, do they want them affiliated? Do they not want them affiliated?
Right. Like, I know they mention the Eurosport guys regularly, but I don't know if they mention the other guy as much. But
probably not.
Yeah, I mean, for PR reasons, I would hope not. You know.
So I went to UCLA, and I also had like hidden motivation to like try to do film, and that's because it's a Los Angeles, which is like kind of the center of like, you know, the film industry in America. But also, one of our professors was James Franco, and in order to his class. Like, you either have to be a film minor or you like have to apply to be a film minor and submit an application for why you're interested in his particular class. I did not get in, although I applied. I was like, I could do a film minor just for fun.
Right.
But But it's a great, like, I think that a lot of horror films have actually come from UCLA too. And I think I also had a hidden motivation for doing that Scandinavian class, which is A, I like horror, but the guy who taught the class actually wrote a book about EMS cases. Like,
Oh,
isn't that
sweet.
cool?
Yeah, that's
Yeah,
awesome.
so you're like, oh, wow. So you're not just like a Scandinavian professor, but you're also like a journalist.
Yeah.
Where I grew up, I didn't have any known people that I believe had stories like yours, but Will Ferrell went to my high school, and I
Oh.
guess he was like kind of a big shot
I
after
could see
his whole
that.
like elf thing, and you know he became big. And but no one is scary, and the legend himself, Kobe Bryant, used to practice in my high school gym.
Really?
Which, yeah, every time he was there, though, like people would find out and they would rush to the gym, because that's where he would shoot hoops. And he did a shout out for us one time on our, you know, like school TV channel. That
That's
was like,
awesome.
yeah, it was more or less a different experience. But your experience sounds kind of like I would want to follow up on these people, sort of thing.
I heard you typing when I mentioned those names, so you'll definitely have to do your you'll go down a rabbit hole. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, I had to see who these people are actually.
Yeah,
So,
exactly.
yep.
That's funny. So I definitely want to get an exchange of horror movies because I have some that I really like. Like for example, Hereditary was awesome. I thought that was awesome. And then
Oh, didn't that just come out like 2 years ago?
Yeah, like 2018, and it won like a bunch of awards, and it was.
Is it the one where the girl is driving down this like long she's just like driving down the road, someone sticks out their head and then gets hit by a pole and then is decapitated.
Yeah, we gotta get mentioned spoiler alerts before that, but yeah, that's the one,
Okay. Yeah, I don't
yeah.
I think I watched it actually.
I
Oops.
liked that one a
Spoiler
lot.
alerts.
Yeah, big time, but it's all good. It doesn't change the rest of the movie. That one was really cool, and then The Ritual on Netflix I thought was really freaking cool.
Okay, I'm gonna have to put that one on my to watch list, The Ritual.
One of the guys from
Okay.
an episode of Black Mirror is one of the main characters.
Oh, okay. Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
I will definitely put that on my to watch list. You, I know, had mentioned previously, prior to this podcast, that you like superheroes.
Oh yeah.
Did you
And
watch Marvel's Runaways?
no. Let me take a
Okay.
look at that.
It's kind of one of those like mystery, like, and at the end is like kind of like a horror kind of thing. So you might like it.
I'll have to check that out. Yeah, I'm looking at it up right now. That looks pretty cool. And I know when we talked, I was telling you about the DC app as well.
Yeah, I literally downloaded it and didn't have a chance to really look
Yeah.
into it.
I still haven't finished that Superman movie that I was telling you about. I'm like halfway through. I just kind of watch like, 5, 7 minutes at a time when I can. But it's awesome. That movie, Red Son, where Superman was landed in the Soviet Union instead of Kansas. It's an awesome movie so far.
I can imagine, like that's like a whole alternate reality kind of thing, and kind of, I can't imagine like how many historical tie-ins that would actually have or like implications, you know,
Yeah, it's
like.
been really cool so far. So, highly recommend that. But, and then you, the Vigilantes yourself, you kind of shout that out in via Arrow, right?
Yeah. Arrow, when I was in college, came out, and the premise of the show, it's kind of ridiculous. Like no one becomes like a superhero like on an island. But in terms of like his change in character and how he goes from becoming like a playboy billionaire to like a disciplined kind of social justice activist is truly like something that I truly enjoyed watching. And the fact that it takes place on an island is kind of interesting because as a resident, I worked with a lot of like IMGs and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, like you went to an island and it changed you. Like kind of same thing, you know? Like I didn't go to a Caribbean medical school, but a lot of people I know did. And that was something that that also kind of motivated that.
That's pretty cool, yeah.
So that's one of the that's a couple of reasons why I like that show. But also the main actor can do the salamander ladder. And I don't know if you've ever tried to do a salamander ladder. What's certainly that? It's basically like a ladder where you have to do a pull up and then push the bar into the next level.
Oh, like American Ninja Warrior.
Yes. I think it's on American Ninja Warrior, but that's one of the main exercises that they portray the main character doing. And as someone who cannot do a pull-up and who aspires to do one day, that's like something that just like, it was like, I enjoy watching this. Like I said, I was like really into like personal training and stuff like that. So I just enjoy exercising. Aspire to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Are you gonna go as Lady Arrow to the next Comic-Con once the world opens back up?
Actually, so the Black Canary was one of the main characters in the new movie based on Joker's girlfriend, Harley Quinn. If you watch the movie Harley Quinn, it just came out. I didn't watch that movie, but the Black Canary is actually Arrow's, like, I guess, love interest. So I was telling my fiance that he's going to be Arrow, and I'm going to be Black Canary for the next Comic-Con.
That would be pretty sweet. Yeah, that would be cool.
And it's a pretty, like, wide... I think it's a pretty well-recognized couple in the comic universe. So... when it does happen and when it safely happens, or maybe Comic-Con might even just take place in like a huge outdoor venue, like
that would be,
you know,
cool,
where they have like people kind of separated like enough to like socially distance. Like that's what I see kind of future conferences being, is like more outdoors and have people like really distanced from each other and wearing a mask, and it would just allow for more ventilation and stuff like that.
The problem with, you know, events like that and even just medical conferences, like, okay, we have them, say, like in California where there's not as much rain, for example, so you can kind of count on outdoors being okay, but everyone has to travel there still, you know? So you still have to go all over the world, all the airports and everything. It's like, it sucks, man. This whole situation sucks. I think the biggest disappointment of all the shutdowns, like graduations, weddings, like, and I'm sorry about your wedding getting canceled, but the biggest disappointment is definitely Comic-Con not happening this year. So that's like, that's the worst thing that happened from Corona as far as shutdowns go.
That's definitely one of the things that is going to impact people who love comics. I think that, you know, what is, you know, pro and con about this whole pandemic is healthcare workers have become superheroes. And
yes.
And I think that, you know, as much as like I'm disappointed that San Diego Comic-Con is not happening, most likely New York Comic-Con is not happening, it's that like maybe we've already projected like the things that we wanted to portray into our daily lives, you know? Like, why do we dress up to be these things? It's more that we, you know, we like those characters or we like what experiences that they went through, But most superheroes have like a struggle story, you know, where they have to overcome something. Like for example, like for Peter Parker, it's like he isn't truly happy with his self-image before becoming Peter Parker, and he gains like confidence and all these other things, you know, or like Spider-Man, sorry. But for most healthcare workers, I feel like this pandemic has been like riveting in terms of, I don't know, being in the emergency department, like all of a sudden, oh wow, like thank you, doctor. Like I've never gotten so much appreciation for the things I do, even if they're very simple, than during coronavirus. Like
that's
all of
awesome,
a sudden
though.
I'm getting like free food. Like it's weird. Like I don't expect these things either. Like that's not why we went into medicine, but all of a sudden, yeah, it's just crazy, you know? I don't know what your thoughts are on that are, or if you...
I haven't experienced it necessarily as a student or as an intern now, but I definitely see it though elsewhere. Like a lot of just like the signs, and even in town where I am now, there's a lot of graffiti all over, you know, thank you to our, you know, medical heroes, things like that. And I think, so where I am in Western Carolina, it's mountainous, it's kind of rural, so we don't have a huge case a load as much as like Charlotte, which is the biggest city in the state, is huge. I mean, there's a lot of cases there, so it's already kind of like we've been protected, but there's plenty of cases relatively. So it's kind of cool to see that, kind of like you said, it's a bigger appreciation for the healthcare field, nurses, everyone, you know. And I think even people who didn't really necessarily get a lot of respect, even though they had respectable parts of the whole piece, like respiratory therapists and OTs and speech therapy and physical therapists, and you know, people didn't realize, you know, when things first shut down, you couldn't go to PT after a surgery, like how important PT really is, you know, or OT or things like that. And so it's cool, like that is one of the pluses, that people kind of finally are appreciating and understanding the true value of healthcare in general. So I think that's one plus for sure.
Yeah, and I hope that they continue to appreciate healthcare workers, and even like, you know, people who work ancillarily to healthcare staff more. Like our environmental workers, our janitors, like we couldn't do it without them, you know? Like,
yeah, the people who go in and clean the COVID bed after the patient leaves, you know?
Exactly. So incredibly important.
Well, we've been talking for like almost 90 minutes. Kind of crazy, huh?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, this is like a long time. I was actually going to say my computer's like at 4% now. So I was
Hey. Well.
But this is really fun.
I'm glad.
I had a lot of fun.
I usually do wrap-up questions. Let's try to wrap those up, bang those out really quick before your computer dies. How about that?
Okay, sounds good.
All right. So the first one is, has emergency medicine been what you expected?
Yes and no. Emergency medicine is definitely expect the unexpected. And with this pandemic, yes, absolutely unexpected. But there are some things that I feel like I expected, which was crazy stories and all these other, you know, things that carry on to my real life. But I would say I wouldn't trade it for anything else.
Gotcha. Okay, perfect. And then next question, and I'm only going fast just so you, because your computer, so I apologize if I'm kind of rushing through these.
No, I'm just turning down the brightness, so it's fine.
Okay. So the next question is, what are, in your opinion, keys to success in medicine?
Keys to success. I think that every medical student comes in with a certain mindset that they want to work hard, alleviate pain, and really help people. And in order to successfully do this, I think that there's a lot of, you know, hurdles, where people you know, have to jump through like a lot of standardized testing or a lot of like formalities to really get to the stage where they are able to help people in the ways that they want to help people. In order to be successful, I think it's important not to lose sight of the things that matter to you. Like, if you want to be empathetic, don't ever stop placing yourself in someone else's shoes. If you want to be compassionate, don't ever think that the only reason the person in, you know, you're treating is yelling at you is entirely your fault. And if you want to, you know, truly make a difference, spend the time to make it and don't just rush through things that really matter to you. And I think that's kind of the most important aspects of medicine that I think make it, you know, make someone successful practicing it.
So that kind of answers the third question too, which to an extent, but I'd love to ask the third question as well, which is, you know, you being a big boss lady now, you know, being a fellow and having completed residency and everything, what is your advice to those on their way up? So maybe current residents, current medical students, or even pre-meds?
Well, you know, my road was very long. I didn't really talk about it much, but I think I've been rejected more times than not. I didn't even get into a single volunteering activity during my first couple of years in college for like volunteering at a hospital because it was so competitive. But even in medical school, I feel like I didn't really like do much, quote unquote. But I think that the things that have made this journey easier is accepting failure and finding ways to continue to do the things that you love. My main advice is not to give up. It doesn't matter if you get a C in like one course in college. At the end of the day, no one is gonna ask you what grades you got. I know a lot of people are tied up, like I need to be number one or I need to be number two. I entirely went through the public education system in America and I did just fine. It doesn't matter really, truly what school you go to if, you know, your goals are to do the best wherever you go. And I think that not accepting failure for just, you know, what it is and really moving past it and finding ways to do the things that you love, because guess what? A lot of people have failed before you is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Also, like meet as many people as you can, network. You know, they do say that it's not what you know and who you know. And I think that that also goes a long way, because who you know will give you opportunities that you never thought possible. I only wrote a case report in medical school because I went to a lunch conference one time where they were like, hey, you know, there's this attending writing a case report. Anyone want to help? And literally I was like, hey, I'd like to help. And the next thing I know, I'm on a paper. And that's like my research for medical school. So it's truly network, 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 meet people, be open. And don't just think that studying is the only thing, because that's not going to be what's going to save the patient at bedside. It's going to be how you say the things that you say.
Absolutely. Sweet. That's awesome advice. I mean, for those coming up and just in general, as far as key points to success, I like that. So the last question I have for you is, if you woke up tomorrow and you were 10 years old and you had to redo everything over to get to where you are today, would you do it all over again?
Oh, absolutely. There is one change, though. I probably would eat more ice cream on the way, because I've just recently discovered all the flavors that I love. But yes, absolutely.
Okay, respect. I like that. Ice cream is one of my favorite vices as well, so I concur with that.
I love it. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This was an awesome conversation. I had a really good time learning about kind of your journey and then just everything else as well. That was really fun. So thanks so much for your time and being a guest. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to, you know, continuing our conversations and whatnot. So be great.
I'll have to have you on in the future again so we can maybe check out how fellowship was, and we can also kind of talk about your route to and through, because I usually like to get into that, but it didn't happen this time. But we had an awesome conversation still, so I definitely no regrets on that front.
Thank you, Everett. I'm honored to be here, and I would love to talk to you again soon. I'm sure we will.
All right,
and
absolutely.
Until then, continue eating ice cream, because I recommend it.
Oh, most definitely. You don't have to worry about that. Plenty of things to worry about. I'll take care of that for sure, though.
Okay. All right. Take care. Good luck.
All right. Bye. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Bye.
All right. Thanks.
That was Siri, recent graduate of emergency medicine and currently doing an ultrasound fellowship. Thank you so much for listening. To those in the game and those on their way up, keep grinding and don't let anyone take your dream away from you.
Praise the Lord, everybody. I woke up this morning just really feeling excited and happy, and I just felt good.